I'm always particularly thrilled to come up to this district, and it's especially a source of pleasure to come to Cohoes, having been one of the few people who's labored through issues of the Cohoes Cataract, the newspaper from the 19th century, and had the opportunity really to share in the history of this city. It gives me particular kind of pleasure to be able to bring something of that history back. I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to tell you very much more than I've already written about that history, but I'm going to pull on various bits and pieces as a way to try to talk about what I think it begins to suggest to us about the lessons for the new millennium. For the Music Hall, it seems to me, is a particularly glorious place, and it's part of the grandeur that once made a place like Cohoes and the Harmony Mills a byword around the world for its cloth production. But buildings and architecture tell a story as well, I would have us say, about inequality and about the use and abuse of power. That's to say, there are resources and they can be spent on glorious facilities like this, but not necessarily spent in other kinds of ways, like a worker's wage. And so we need to talk a little bit about the priorities and the use and abuse of power in the city. The mansard roofs on the Harmony Mills, on the Ogden Mill, for instance, were put up in 1875. Those are those very elaborate French roofs, including the statuary that was put into those roofs. It was all done, it's useful to remember, during the Great Industrial Depression from 1873 to 1877. While wages were being cut, the mill owners still had the money to put up those very fancy roofs. Again, priorities. The use, the abuse of power. The Harmony Mills are indeed an extraordinary bit of industrial social engineering. And they are not simply the mills, but of course the entire, what I call company town, but the entire apparatus in which they fit. A social apparatus that includes the tenement houses, company store, churches, that were all part of the social life that the mills structured for its workers. 800 tenements were erected, isolated by the cliff and descending to the mill gate in a perfect kind of isolated architectural statement in which the workers would descend into the gate where they'd be controlled and entered, and they'd be looked over from the mansion on the hill, Longview, where the superintendent, David Johnson, had his home. The company store opened in 1857, and as you know, wages, costs were simply deducted from those from wages in order to meet the needs that you had in company stores. You were given housing, and the housing was at a what's called reasonable wage, a reasonable cost. However, you must remember that wages were infinitesimal. One could not live on the wages that you made in textile mills. That's why multiple members of families not only had the opportunity to work, had no choice but to work if you were going to get by. It's often structured as the opportunity to work in the mills. Well, one needs to remember that someone else offering you the opportunity may be for you a necessity, because you couldn't live on the wage that children made in those mills. And most of the workforce was under the age of 20, and most of the workforce were young women who were paid poorly. You had houses, but indeed, because they were company houses, if you threatened to strike, you were threatened with potential eviction. You didn't simply have to be evicted. You had to know you could be evicted. Indeed, evictions would take place. As you know from those of you who have seen the video downstairs and the enactment, quite a smashing job. I just saw it actually a bit this evening. It was like rereading my book. It was quite terrific. I quite liked it. It's lovely to see something you've written a long time ago still brought to life that way. Workers are not evicted until 1882, but I'll come back to that in a minute. The Harmony Hills had a Sunday Sabbath school. It had 360 pupils in 1864. It had many more after that, again, under Superintendent David Johnston's direction. So it is, again, the mill superintendent helping to provide for the spiritual well-being, but also controlling the messages that they were to hear in those churches. And those messages, needless to say, were usually non-union messages. There was a reading room and a library provided for everybody with what were called a well-stocked collection. But I assure you, and I don't know this for a fact, but I expect Capital was not part of that collection. The Communist Manifesto was not part of that collection. Years later, it would not be the IWW songbook, which you can get downstairs. It was not part of a well-stocked library collection. So there were books there to be read, but one needs again to ask, what are we to read? What are we expected to learn? Usually you were to learn, in their minds, to be a Republican voter. That's to say, not to be voting with labor. The power of paternalism and deference, and they need to be read together. Paternalism was as much about teaching people a sense of respect and awe with power as anything else. Deference was reflected in the fact that the ward in which the Harmony Mills was located tended to vote Democratic, except when people like Johnston or William Thorne, the company treasurer, ran for mayor, and then the voters tended to vote for them. So even with this kind of controlling condition, they respect and fear ran together hand in hand, those twin sides of a coin, the carrot and the stick of deference, of paternalism. So power was also reflected not just in the architecture of social life, but in unequal resources as well. Popular ideology, the books that one was expected to read, were the Horatio Alger stories that told everyone about the possibility to grow from rags to riches, the Andrew Carnegie story. And indeed, it was possible in America. But rags to riches was not the typical story for most people. You went from the mill, not to become the superintendent, you went from the mill to the grave. That was the typical trajectory of most people's lives. The mill labor force peaked at nearly 5,000. That meant that among adults, at least one in two were involved in direct work in the mills, often many more than that, and indirectly, the entire economy was structured by what's happening in the mill experience. Half, as I said, were under 20, but the percentage under 15 tripled between 1860 and 1880. That suggests something about the opportunities for success, that in order for a family to get by 1880, three times as many young people under the age of 15 had to be at work in the mills, had to be there in order to sustain the family economy, if the family was to simply get by. Two-thirds were female, and most were Irish in 1860 and Irish and French-Canadian by 1880. That's to say, had someone from the Taxi Limousine Commission been here today, they would have told us a story of immigration and immigrants and immigrant labor, but that is not a new story in America. It's an old story, though a story with ever-changing dimensions, a story that's increasingly racialized as well in the 20th century, though the ways in which immigrants were often treated as if they were of a different race as well. The wages of most mill hands were barely above minimal subsistence wage. The only ones who got that were mule spinners. Almost everybody else required multiple families to work. The typical family were Patrick and Ellen Dillon. They left Ireland in the midst of a potato famine in the 1840s. They arrived in New York City about 1850 with six children, four boys, age 10, 8, 6, and 4, and two-year-old twin girls. They had another boy in 1854, a daughter in 1857, and another baby in 1859. In the 1860 census, the Dillons, now having arrived in Cohoes, had nine children. Ellen, in fact, was pregnant as well with what would be their 10th child. They now lived in Cohoes and worked in the Harmony Mills, sharing a four-room tenement owned by the company at 4 Willow Street. Patrick had saved about $300 by having two eldest sons, Michael and William, who were now aged 20 and 18, respectively, answer the 6 o'clock chime from the factory bell and walk down into the Harmony Mills to work. A third son, Patrick Jr., joined his father as a day laborer, perhaps on a canal or on a railroad gang, or perhaps working for the company itself. Working for the company, they may have been helping the Harmony build new tenements. They could have been enlarging the newly acquired Ogden Mills. Mrs. Dillon was occupied at home. Matthew, age 14, and the 12-year-old twin girls now did not yet work. Only the 6-year-old boy attended school of all of them. The baby had only just celebrated her first birthday and must have required considerable attention. So too, a three-year-old daughter. As I've mentioned, she was pregnant, taking care of all of these kids. The men came home for lunch on their 40-minute noon break and then returned to the mills. At 6:30, remember they had left work and started at 6, at 6:30 the closing bell rang. For these 12 hours of work, an adult common laborer received 75 cents, while a skilled mule spinner received up to twice that. Women, especially children who labored in the mills, received considerably less. A back boy, for example, received 30 cents for his 12-hour day. Now, if you multiply that by 200, you can see 30 cents times 200 was going to fall well below what a family of four needed to get by, close to $450 to $600 a year. So this was just at best a help in meeting, in fact, the costs of simply feeding that extra mouth. But work in the mills was reasonably steady, and each of the two unskilled Dillon boys employed there probably earned an annual wage of $200. Therefore, the estimated family wage of the Dillons in 1860 was about $750. When the monthly payday arrived in the mills, the tenement house rent of $5 to $7 was deducted. The rest they lived on. Patrick Dillon died in the 1860s, but his widow continued to maintain the family home. Finally, in 1875, she moved to Orchard Street a few blocks away, where she worked occasionally as a dressmaker. Of her children, Patrick Jr. died suddenly in 1870 at the age of 26, shortly before his marriage, and James died on September 15, 1874, at the age of 19, both from undisclosed sources. You've heard of their social mobility. Michael and Matthew appeared periodically in the city directories as mill hands. Michael lived with the family for a few years in the mid-70s, only disappearing from the directory in 1879, perhaps moving out of town. Matthew, though, moving almost yearly, remained on the hill and thus near the family. Although listed each year in the directory as a spinner, skilled worker, he does not appear in the 1880 census schedule. By 1880, the older girls had probably married, and the rest of the Dillons still lived in their old house. William, the second eldest son 20 years earlier, had become the head of the household. William Dillon had married an Irish-born woman, Elizabeth, soon after the Civil War. In 1866, their son, now Patrick III, was born, followed 3 years later by a daughter, Hannah. He had had considerable weight, however, thrust on his shoulders with his father's death and the death of his elder brother. His job in the mill now had to support not only his own family of four, but also his widowed mother and her four children, none of whom yet worked. Family economics required that the family open their small home to another Irish family, John Cahill, his wife and two children, and to an Irish boarder. Both of the male laborers also worked in the mills, and the additional income helped sustain the family. That's to say, in order to get by, one had to economize, one had to take in boarders, one had to double up, one had to take care of multiple families, one had to live in extended families with relatives. That's what it meant to be mobile. It meant to survive. Mill work for these people hardly changed, except that the pace got tougher. The pace sped up. Hours had been reduced slightly, but more children and now more French-Canadian children often labored. And the opening bell rang a half hour later. But the mills remained a central part of these people's lives. Only one, Dillon, 20-year-old Patrick in 1880, whose grandfather had arrived in America only 40 years earlier, was able to leave the mills and return to school. He became a student, and with it required the occupational and social status traditionally afforded to the educated. Though many of his relatives, for many of them, mobility had only been from the mills to the grave, young Patrick had achieved an avenue to status with both he and the dominant culture could celebrate. I want to contrast that experience with the Harmony Mills managerial elite. Robert Johnston was born in Dalston, Carlisle, in England on February 2, 1807. He worked in Northumberland, cotton mills, at the age of seven, becoming an expert mule spinner. He immigrated to the United States in 1834, I believe. My notes say here 44, I vaguely recall 34, and settled in Providence, Rhode Island, where he became a friend and co-worker of Samuel Slater, generally known as the father of American cotton mills. He became renowned, however, as a technological pioneer, and after taking charge of a local cotton mill in Volusia, New York, which was owned by a man named Nathan Wild, who was the father of one of the purchasers of the Harmony Mill in 1850, this Johnson, Robert Johnson, becomes now the new superintendent of the Harmony Mills in Cohoes. He, by the way, also is well known as the first to spin a kind of worsted fabric in the United States. So he was a skilled artisan, but he comes, frankly, with all the kinds of advantages he can have and connections in American society. None of that is illustrated better, however, than the treasurer. Johnson is installed as the superintendent and has supervised the vast expansion and consolidation of cotton production in Cohoes until Carmody Mills had a monopoly on all cotton production. Unlike knit goods, there were 17 knit good factories. There are four cotton mills in Cohoes in 1860. By 1880, there is one mill. It controls all the jobs in the city. If they tell you to go get a job in cotton mills elsewhere, it ain't in Cohoes. Okay? His son David, not requiring any particular social mobility, any kind of social mobility from the bottom up, becomes superintendent simply through genetic engineering. He knew his father. William Thorne was the Harmony agent and treasurer from 1867 to 1910. And he illustrates how textile manufacturers were part of an interlocking directorate that controlled much of the social life in the city and made decisions to spend money on places like this. Not that they're bad things to build, just remember what was happening to wages. William Thorne was the son-in-law of Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt. He was the nephew of Thomas Garner, who was the other person who purchased the Harmony Mills in 1850. He had a law degree from Columbia College, and he became the executor of Thomas Garner's daughter's estates. Thomas Garner had three daughters, all of whom became titled heiresses. He moved to Cohoes in 1867, became director of the Cohoes Water Company, which controlled all the water power in the city, the secretary and treasurer of the Cohoes Gas Light Company, a director and first president of the Manufacturers Bank of Cohoes. He also becomes mayor of Cohoes in 1878 and 1880. I should note that Robert Johnston was president of the Mechanics Savings Bank and also served as mayor. These people had power, political and economic power. The response to that power, however, from people like the Dillons and other workers required a source of power on their own, and it tended to be collective power. It required the collective power of workers, and they joined unions to create it. In Cohoes, building among the first sustained textile worker unions in the country. There had been textile worker unions going back into the 1830s. These become fairly sustained and powerful unions. They wage a successful strike in 1858 to have wages restored after a panic strikes the city in 1857. After a fourth wage reduction in the 1870s, four wage reductions while they're building those mansard roofs, in 5 years, the fourth one is in 1879, finally, the weavers say, enough. And in mill number one, they go out on strike in March of 1880 against asking for a 10% increase in their wages, asking for an end to what was known as the docking system, where they arbitrarily were being docked wages when they were being told that their production was sloppy, and asking for an increase in the lunch break from 40 minutes to an hour. It becomes a general strike of 5,000 Harmony Mills hands in which they are successful, winning on all counts after 9 days. They also, however, won the enmity of the bosses for that strike, who mobilized to say next time they would not sit idly back in the face of organized labor. In March of 1882, The manufacturers implemented a 10% wage reduction again. And that resulted in a four-month strike in which these largely women and children paid a pittance, stayed out against the enormous wealth of this corporation and the enormous wealth of families like the Johnsons who didn't have to worry about where their next paycheck was coming from. Management now made frontal assaults on the worker community by announcing that they would bring in 50 scab Swedish workers and begin evictions of 14 strike leaders. Only one was evicted, and that was Joseph Delahanty. And therein lies the story for the new millennium. Joseph Delahanty. His career was equally impressive to that of some of the mill owners. He was born of Irish parents in Stonebridge, England. In 1845, he may have shared with other English-born cotton workers some early familiarity with the trade union movement. He may have even shared a secret delight with breaking machines. Little is known about his first years of migration to America, though he apparently learned the trade of a cotton spinner at an early age and worked for many years in the Harmony Mills. In 1874, as the Democratic candidate, he was elected to represent the Harmony Hill Ward on the Cohoes City Commission. After failing in an attempt to lead the Reform Democrats, Delahanty worked for the Greenback Labor Party in Cohoes. By early 1882, he'd assumed positions of leadership across the spectrum of Irish working-class institutions in Cohoes. He was elected vice president of both the Albany Trades Association and the Cohoes Irish National Land and Labor League. He drafted a resolution on behalf of the League, as well as the Cohoes Irish American Societies, urging that the American federal government protect all Irish American citizens, especially the Fenians, who were still, quote, incarcerated in British dungeons. In March of 1882, he was elected school commissioner for Cohoes' first ward. Perhaps most important, it was he who led the 1882 Harmony Mills strike. As leader of the strike, Delahanty probably intentionally had himself evicted in order to galvanize support and illustrate the heartless power of the corporation. Indeed, management wanted to threaten evictions. It isn't clear they wanted to force evictions for just that reason that it might galvanize the workers. But Delahanty, clever man that he was, took the initiative out of their hands and forced it. And enforcing his eviction did galvanize the working class. Delahanty became the martyr, and his vindication became further cause for the workers. Alas, manufacturers had great sources of power at their disposal, time and money and the ideology of a free market that could be buttressed by the courts and popular opinion makers like the press, newspapers like the Troy Record, which were virulently anti-labor, the sort of place that might tell you that tonight's meeting was held at the Troy Savings Bank. After 15 weeks, Harmony reopened and for the next 3 weeks used intimidation, threats of eviction, wage enticements to starving families to operate the mills with a skeleton workforce. They even hired 5 special policemen, the sort that we would now call Pinkertons, to guard the mills and further intimidate workers. Indeed, after 4 months in August 1882, the workers voted to go back to work, accepting the decrease in their wages. But the workers resolved to create in its wake a permanent trade union association for struggles yet to come and to join a national labor movement. Even in accepting this defeat, they wrote, resolved that we do not consider it as a defeat, neither do we consider the question of capital and labor settled in Cohoes. We have shown this corporation that they underestimated the strength and intelligence of their work people. Resolved that we shall join and unite in that great phalanx of labor that is known as the Knights of Labor. So the Swedish workers arrived and were met by stones. The workers joined the Knights of Labor, and in the fall election, they sent their message to manufacturers loud and clear. Joseph Delahanty had been elected to chair the fall meeting of the State Labor Convention in Buffalo that fall, carrying, and then in the elections of November, carrying the banners of the Democratic Party, the Albany County Trades Association, the anti-monopolists, and the Cohoes Working Men's Party, Delahanty was elected to represent Cohoes in the state assembly. And in that assembly, Delahanty helped to reverse legislation, anti-labor legislation that had been on the books for 50 years, such as that which allowed for convict prison labor, which had been used to undermine worker wages since the 1830s. Of course, the Harmony Mills cotton producers could use arguments about the free market to move production to the South and say, we're free to go and do what we wish with our labor. But Delahanty had left a message of a different sort, that workers could fight to reverse laws that had made such freedom the handmaiden of manufacturers' slavery. And therein, it seems to me, lies the lessons for the new millennium. Thanks.